and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Candace LaPage, and Halloween is coming, so you better believe it's a good time to have Candace on the show. Whether or not you will enjoy this week's movie, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure if I did, and I hope that isn't too much of a spoiler, but do stick around because I think it will be an interesting conversation. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror comedy sequel, The Babysitter, Killer Queen, which you can now stream on your Netflix app. Now, last week we had a review of a documentary, which you can also now watch on Netflix. It is called Kiss the Ground, and it was basically about how carbon sequestration and better farming techniques in terms of both raising livestock and raising crops and things are ideal ways to reduce the or to mitigate climate change and all the environmental stuff that is happening right now. You may be aware that we have a big agricultural college at the University of Guelph, the Ontario Agricultural College. And just sort of like on a whim, after I watched Kiss the Ground, I went to the OAC website at the University of Guelph, where they list all their experts in their various fields of expertise. And it turns out, at the University of Guelph, there is an expert in carbon sequestration. His name is Rafael Santos, and he works, actually, he's an engineer at the University of Guelph, and he will explain sort of why there's a kind of distinction between what he does in terms of using minerals and capturing carbon with the use of minerals and typical practices of carbon sequestration. But this research is literally happening in our backyard, and I thought, well, that's definitely worth like investing some of our time here on our movie review and pop culture fun show to talk about real research and real world stuff going on with things we see in movies. Especially the movie review we did last week with Kiss the Ground. So, without further ado, I will introduce Professor Rafael Santos from the University of Guelph, who will talk about carbon sequestration and the science behind that. And we will get into that conversation with a question about just how technologically dependent this research is, and whether or not you know, farms in our area could start doing this today. Can small farms start doing this? Big farms, you know, what are the technological requirements? Well, let's listen to Professor Rafael Santos and see what he has to say.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we have considered a lot in our research, is try to develop the process in such a way that farmers would be very willing to do it. And our thinking has always been, well, farmers already tend to spread a lot of things on their farms. They spread fertilizer, they spread, some of them spread the pesticides or other chemicals. A lot of them spread limestone. They're trying to regulate the pH of their soil, so they spread limestone, which is already a mineral. And what we found is that our CO2 sequestering minerals can be spread in much the same way. So it's not any extra work. It doesn't require any new machinery. Doesn't require a whole lot of new knowledge. And once it's in the soil, it pretty much just works on its own. So it's not something that you have to pay very close attention to do a lot of soil testing. It's something relatively straightforward. And the truth is that the farmers have already been doing this. One of the big discoveries, let's say, that we made at the very beginning of our research, we were looking for, okay, so what mineral can we use? And then we went around and we found a company here in Ontario. They're called the Canadian Wollastonite. They're a mining company located near Kingston. And so they mine this mineral called wollastonite. And they have already been selling this for farmers. So even before they thought about the whole possibility of CO2 sequestration, they found that farmers were interested in the, these minerals for other reasons. As some farmers think that it helps kill fungus. Some farmers think that it helps make the soil more porous so it can hold more water. So all of these additional, say, agricultural benefits, they have already been marketing in that way. And so when we approached this company and we said, oh, but your mineral also reacts to CO2, it might be at the same time sequestering CO2. And that's how we started our research. We said, okay, so let's do some control trials. Let's find a farmland, spread this mineral, see what happens. And we were also lucky that we were able to access farms that have already been using this for several years. And we went to those farms. We went to a soybean farm, potato farm, lettuce farm, and we sampled their soils. And we saw exactly what we thought. We saw that the soils that had received more mineral now had more CO2. And so, yeah, so that's really what got our research going. And nowadays we just trying to, on the one hand, understand better what happens, understand the long-term consequences. And then on the other hand, we're trying to see, okay, so how do we get more farmers to do this?
Yeah, and it sounds a bit, from what you're talking about there with visiting farms that were already doing this, it seems like one of those farmers' almanac things that people who have been in farming for generations sort of understand that, you know, maybe science is now catching up with and learning how to make that this kind of like a more universal thing that it can be adapted to all kinds of farms and not just maybe the smaller farms that have been doing it forever.
Yeah. So that's true. There is a lot of knowledge already accumulated on agriculture, but there's always that's the thing with science, that there's always the opportunity to look at it as something from a different point of view and then get a new idea, find a new approach. That's basically what happened in my case. I am not an agricultural engineer or scientist. I'm a chemical engineer by training. Mm-hmm. So that's how I originally got involved in this whole CO2 story. I was trying to sequester CO2 from industrial emissions because that's what a chemical engineer should be trying to do. And then once I came to Guelph, I realized that, well, Guelph is the number one university in Canada for agriculture. We have the Ministry of the Environment of Agriculture right beside our campus. Yeah. It makes sense now to try to see what can I do that relates to agriculture. And that's where all the dots connected, the whole mineral in soil in agriculture and so on.
It's nice when things work out. I think the movie, and maybe it's because of the nature of you know, the movie and the documentary that is presenting this idea of carbon sequestration and the work you're doing as maybe not necessarily a magic cure to climate change worries, but a pretty big step. From your own research, though, I mean, how much can carbon sequestration do to help us mitigate and turn back the growth of carbon in the atmosphere? I guess what are the limits of carbon sequestration in terms of fighting climate change?
Yeah, so what we have to keep in mind is that there is not one single solution that will resolve climate change. That's on the one hand because of the amount of CO2 that we're talking about. So every year we're still putting up 40 or so gigatons of CO2 to the atmosphere. And we need very large solutions to make a meaningful impact on either reducing those emissions or getting it back from the atmosphere. So there's not one approach. There is a concept called the climate change stabilization wedges. We actually published one of our papers with a similar title. So the idea was that, I forgot the name of the researcher, but a few years ago, some researchers published a paper where they showed these wedges, and each wedge would be one approach to mitigating climate change. And so some of those wedges would be improving energy efficiency in industrial processes, converting fossil fuel cars into electric cars, converting fossil fuel power stations into solar and wind and so on. And then you would get into the CO2 sequestration approaches. So you might have a wedge related to the most popular, or at least the biggest scale approach to CO2 sequestration has been for the last 10, 15, 20 years, what we call geological sequestration, right? So geological sequestration is where we take the CO2, we concentrate it. That's one of the issues with it. You have to have a pretty much pure CO2. You pump it, the CO2, in fact, that becomes a liquid. It's not a gas anymore. And then you inject this underground. And you can inject it into cavities or underground seawater, or you can even inject it into rock with the hope that the CO2 will react with the rock and stay there. And the reason why this has been for the past 10, 15 years, the number one approach is because of scale. So it's the one that people thought that, oh, this one has a big scale. It can almost capture all of the CO2 that we're emitting. The issue is that as time has passed, we have found that, not all of those places that we thought we could inject the CO2 work. Some of them might leak. Some of them are not reactive enough. Some of them, and like one good example I always like to use is that there was a big project in Europe. So they were going to take a steel maker, retrofit the steel mill so that it could capture CO2, put it in a pipeline and pump it, and then they would pump it into an underground storage. Now the issue was that the underground storage was in northern France. So northern France has all these little cities and villages and so on, and the people in the area just didn't like the idea. They said, no, we don't want to be living on top of sequestered CO2. and then that pretty much killed the project. You're in northern France. Even if you put it in a pipeline, you're going to have to pump it thousands of kilometers away until you find an empty enough space. So that killed the idea. So what I've sort of noticed, and now I haven't been paying too much attention into geological sequestration, but I've noticed that I think the original idea that it can be the number one biggest solution has declined a bit. So I think people now are more realistic that, it can only do so. So then it goes to the wedge concept. So it can still be a wedge. It's just not going to be a very big wedge. So we need additional wedges. And that's where this soil carbon came in. So people said, the soil carbon can be an additional wedge. And then within this wedge, we can have the better management practices. We can have the adding carbon to soil. And then what my colleague's paper was we said, we can put another little wedge called the enhanced weathering wedge, where you put the minerals in the soil and then they sequester the carbon. Of all the approaches to CO2, like the reason why I'm so big fan of the whole what we call mineral carbonation, reacting CO2 with minerals, is that we do have enough minerals on Earth that we can readily access that can capture all of the CO2 that we emit. There's a scientist called Professor Klaus Lackner. He published a paper in 2003 in Science. And one of the things that he very quickly noted was that all you need is, say, a mountain range. I forgot which mountain range he described in the paper, but he said, if you just take this mountain range, imagine these mountains, let's chop down the mountains, make it into a powder, react it with CO2, we can pretty much capture many, many years of CO2 just with a single mountain worth of mineral. And he was just trying to illustrate that it's a reasonable amount. Yes, it's a large amount of mineral that's needed, but it's still something reasonable. We have it here on Earth. We can mine it. We can react it with CO2. So it does have the potential to sequester a lot. There are concerns with, how much does it cost to mine these minerals? Do you have to transport them a long distance and so on? But at least from a mass balance point of view, there's enough mineral to react with all the CO2 that we need. Going back to the movie in terms of soil, when you look at organic carbon in soil, there is an upper limit. You can only build organic carbon in the soil up to a certain limit, because what the movie discusses is that we want to improve the microbial activity in the soil. They say something about we've killed all these microbes in soil. Mm-hmm. We need to improve our microbial activity. Well, what does microbial activity do? Microbial activity degrades organic matter and turns it back into CO2 and sometimes even worse, it turns it into methane. And methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can build up the organic matter in the soil, but at some point, that decomposition process will limit how much you can put. So there are some soils that already have too much organic matter. We can't build it anymore, and so there isn't an upper limit there. And my other personal concern is that for example, we were saying that the management practices are the best approach to build up soil organic carbon. Well, if it's a management practice, it means that it needs human intervention and it needs continuous human intervention. So say you take a farmland, you convince the farmer that if you do A, B, and C, your soil organic carbon content will double. The farmer does A, B, and C. You come back 5 years later and, oh yes, your soil organic carbon has doubled. You come 10 years later and, oh, it's still there. It's still doubled the original. Then you come 30 years later, and then you find out that, well, that farmer now has left the land for his kids and they went to do something else. And all the organic carbon that was there has gone back to the atmosphere, right? Because the management practice stopped.
Right.
So that's my sort of concern that I have is organic carbon is a temporary storage. It's not a permanent storage.
Right. That's interesting that you bank all this carbon on your land and then, you know, maybe 100, even, you know, 200, 300 years later, or even not that much, but, you know, all that work can be undone and maybe all of a sudden all this carbon is being released again and, you know, we're back to the drawing board.
Yeah. So, the other thing is that there's different fractions of organic carbon in soil. Mm. So there's something called the labile fraction. So the labile fraction is the one that's least stable. So it's the one that readily decomposes. And that basically has a turnover of a few years, between 1 and 5 years. That carbon that was sequestered goes back to atmosphere. And the idea is that that's just a rotating fraction of the soil. So sequester releases. Then there's the second fraction, which soil scientists like to call the humus fraction. That one is a little bit more stable, so that one might stay in the soil for a few decades, but it still will eventually turn over and go back to the atmosphere. Then there's the one that's called the recalcitrant or the resistant organic carbon. That's the one that might be stable for what we call more geological time scale. So then we're talking about hundreds or even thousands of years. The challenge is that the more stable the carbon becomes, the less the amount. So that more decomposable carbon tends to be the biggest fraction of the carbon in the soil. Then comes the humus, and then comes the recalcitrant. So one of the things I've been looking at a little bit in literature, and it's also a bit of a topic of a project I have, is how can we try to build up the most stable fraction of organic carbon? And I would even argue that if you were looking to reward farmers or farmland managers for organic carbon sequestration, it would make sense that you discern between the different organic carbons and put more value in the more stable ones. So it's much easier to take a soil sample, send it to the lab and ask, okay, how much organic carbon is there? You get a number and you can say, oh, this number has doubled and therefore you get this much carbon credit. It does take a bit more work to find out what the different fractions are, but to me, it would make more sense from a long-term perspective. We care more about the more stable fraction, not just about the total carbon.
And once again, that was Professor Rafael Santos of the University of Guelph. And I do believe there is a link in the show notes page on this episode at the End Credits website where you can get some more info about carbon sequestration and the challenges and science behind that. Interesting stuff to be sure. Will it save the future? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. And after this musical break, you will get to well, hear, not see, it's radio, but you will get to hear our review of this week's movie, which is The Babysitter Killer Queen on Netflix. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Playful as a pussycat, momentarily out of action, temporarily out of gas, can absolutely drive you wild, wild. She's a killer queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Oh, recommended at the price, insatiable in appetite, wanna try.
All right, all you lions, this is our new transfer student, Phoebe Atwell. She comes to us from the Guardian Angel program, where upstanding adult citizens nominate disenfranchised youths from juvenile hall to assimilate back into society. Let's give her a warm lion welcome. Class. So, Phoebe, tell us three things about yourself.
Well, I think snakes are the most misunderstood reptiles. My favorite movie vacillates between Deliverance or anything by Rob Reiner. And I'm late.
What are you talking about? You're right on time.
Oh, no, Principal, I abridged my period. I'm 9 days late.
Oh.
And God, I was on the fence about it, but I think I might just keep it now.
And that was a clip from The Babysitter Killer Queen. It is the new film from Joseph McGinty Nichol, a.k.a. McG. And it stars Judah Lewis, Emily Allen Lind, Jenna Ortega, Robbie Amell, Bella Thorne, and Samara Weaving. I am now being joined on the line by Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I am doing well. I have done so many household chores today, I feel like a normal adult.
Wow. That's, you should take a... I don't know, an arthritis med out of petty cash or something. And
I could teach a course in adulting right now. I'm doing it so well today.
Our movie this week is The Babysitter Killer Queen. It is a sequel to a movie I think I had seen in passing on Netflix, but never boldly clicked play on. But you wanted to watch The Babysitter sequel, yes. Killer Queen, and so why don't you begin by offering us your insight into The Babysitter and why you wanted to watch the sequel.
Sure. Unlike you, I did boldly press play on the original Babysitter, I think probably in the week that it was released on Netflix, or somewhere around there. I watched it really early because, as everybody knows, it falls right into my wheelhouse. It's a double wheelhouse. It's teens and horror, so it was really ideal. So I did watch it when it came out, and I quite enjoyed it. And I hadn't really thought of it since because while I quite enjoyed it, Netflix comes out with a lot of these types of movies that are, not that it's a bad thing, but are, pretty formula. Like, they churn them out, and they're all fine movies and great enjoyment, but sometimes they're a little, I don't want to say forgettable, because The Babysitter was not forgettable, but, it's not like the type of thing that I was, singing its praises from the rafters, like a Quiet Place or something. It was sort of like, oh, that was super fun. And there is a super specific audience of people who will like this. And instead of telling any of them, I texted a friend who I knew probably wouldn't enjoy it and convinced him that he should watch it. Maybe I'm a bad friend. I don't know. But so I hadn't really thought about it again until, just in the last few weeks, whenever it was that the sequel came out, and I had to remember, well, how did that end, there's a sequel. Because I will also say that I watched the original at the same time that I watched another sort of teen-based horror movie that was sort of similar. But I think it was... Oh, it's a really good movie, so I don't really want to spoil it. But it's the same sort of thing where there's a babysitter and the boy that she's babysitting, and horror hijinks ensue. And things ended in a different way than they ended in the original Babysitter. It's called Don't Look Now, and it's a Christmas movie. Because just add that third wheelhouse to my teen horror and add Christmas, and it's very exciting. So I did have to remind myself how the first one ended, because I was surprised to see a new one, but also very excited. So I was just like, this is it. It's time. It's time to rewatch The Babysitter and watch Killer Queen also, which I did do.
Yes, and I did the same because I'm obviously not going to blind watch a sequel.
Yeah, and I think in this case, it's a really good plan that you did watch the original, because the sequel, leans heavily on the story of the first one, so...
Yes, it does. Well, how did you feel about the sequel, given your affinity for the first one? Because before I want to get into my thoughts, which are multifaceted, because you were revisiting Babysitter and you enjoyed the first one, I do want to hear what you thought about the second one, just off the cuff.
Yeah, so off the cuff, I was a little nervous pretty early on. I was a little worried that it was really just going to rehash the first one and just go through the whole thing again. And while it did do that a little bit, I also think that it was, the storyline went different enough and in a direction that was not just like, oh, we're just remaking the first one with more spectacular kills. So, you know, it was, I kind of went all over in my emotions. I was just like, oh God, here we go. It's just going to rehash it all. And then it didn't do that. And I was very glad for it.
I mean, horror sequels by their nature kind of rehash. You know, when you think about all the Friday the 13th and all the Nightmare on Elm Streets and all the Halloweens, they are to an extent a rehash of, you get like a new group of teens that the killer targets for some reason, and everything goes from there. I had very mixed feelings at the end of Killer Queen, especially like coming off the high of The Babysitter.
Yes, I will agree with you there. I'm glad it didn't do what I thought it was going to do, but I don't know if I liked what it did do.
Yeah. No, I just I watched The Babysitter like early in the day, and because I usually watch things on the things we review the night before we record them. So I watched it early in the day, and I thought I'll give it like some nice space to like burn off like my expectations going into a sequel, because I was very excited at when we got to the end of it. It really is. I mean, it doesn't remake the wheel, to borrow a phrase, but it is very, very good at using the tropes and the expectations, and like the cast is really, really great. And it had some money behind it, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like gushing money. You know, there were some pretty spectacular kills in the first one, for, you know, what's ostensibly a low budget horror movie in one setting. It was filmed really, really well. It had great energy. And so I didn't want to like go right into the sequel where I'm measuring the sequel directly against that. But having said that, there are some really interesting ideas in Killer Queen. I did like how they introduced the new girl, and she is obviously weird and maybe off-putting to some quarters. And she has the kitten tattoo, which is the one that on her wrist, which is the similar to Samara Weaving in the first movie, which automatically makes you suspicious. I mean, she's the new girl, so you're automatically suspicious of her regardless. But to add that little bit as well, you know, obviously makes you want to keep your eye on her as the potential antagonist, and then to have the twist early on that she is, she not only is sort of coming into this as an innocent, but she also has a connection to the retconned origin story of certain characters too, and that was a lot of fun. On the other hand, though, I'm comparing this to Happy Death Day Part 2 and Happy Death Day. Like, Happy Death Day is not a movie that reinvents the wheel. It's Groundhog Day in a slasher movie, which is, like, when you're going into a meeting with studio executives and that's your elevator pitch, you are sitting pretty in terms of, like, getting people to understand the flavor of what you're trying to sell. But with the Death Day sequel, again, it had some, like, interesting ideas in it, and then it kind of falls into the trap of being too similar to the original that you can't really get that same high off of it. You know, I love the first Happy Death Day. I've rewatched it a ton of times. Well, not a ton, but, you know, at least a good 5 or 6 times from beginning to end. But I'm hard-pressed to revisit the sequel just because I didn't get that rush and that energy from it. And I think it's the same thing. I could certainly see myself going back and rewatching The Babysitter at some point. I don't know if I want to revisit Killer Queen.
Yeah, yeah. There were parts of Killer Queen that I did really like. You know, as you say, the character, the girl that was introduced, that we're you know, a little led to believe is maybe a bad thing. But it doesn't turn out that way. I really liked her character, and I really like that actress as well. Can't get her name right now, but she was also
Jenna Ortega.
Yeah, she was in the second season of the Netflix series You,
with playing Evil sort Dan of Humphrey.
Sort of a similar similar character, like a sassy teen who knows. She's a little too mature for her age. Knows a little bit too much of the, like, evil of the world. I really liked that. I like the theme of this, which is about trauma and surviving from trauma and moving forward and how to do that. I'm not so fond of the retcon. Of two characters, really. It's so difficult because it's pretty early on, but there is a bit of a twist that, you know, I don't know if we really want to talk about, but like one character goes a different way than you expect, and I don't know how I felt about that. And I think that was part of where I was just like, oh great, okay, so it's just going to be the first movie again. But then we got into the sort of the blossoming relationship between Cole and Phoebe, and, you know, a little bit of history from her, and I quite liked that. But I don't know. I just don't buy the ending at all. Mm-hmm. Like the way that it ends is just, yeah. I'm not a fan of the ending. It's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help that Samara Weaving doesn't come back till the ending, doesn't really come back till the ending.
Yeah.
And I understand why. She's become certainly a bigger star since, I think.
Yes, I'm sure she commands a lot more money now than she did in 2016 or 17 when they filmed the first one.
Yes, and that's to be expected. I just feel like the thing that really drove the first film is that sense of betrayal that Cole has about be that you spend so much time with them, you know, just hanging out and having what it seems like a really interesting, you know, brother-sister relationship, although for obvious reasons, Cole would be hard-pressed to say that he has brotherly feelings for B, understandable. But the problem with the film is, again, it's difficult to talk about without spoiling things, but it tries to replicate that sense of betrayal by having another woman in Cole's life turn out to be not what she seems. And the core problem with this is you are so confused trying to figure out the source of the betrayal and why certain decisions have been made off screen that you don't really you're not really engaged with the heady emotional stuff. And it also brings back like all the people who were killed in part one, which is not great. I mean, shirtless Robbie Amell is hilarious.
It's a joke,
but
that worked in the first one, and then the second one it's like, okay, I get it. Yes.
Yeah, it's they took the joke too far.
It's hilarious in the first one. Like, I still laugh when Cole wakes up from having been, you know, sort of knocked out and sees him shirtless. And, like, he's tied up and there are people threatening him with knives. And all he can do is just question, like, why are you shirtless? Like, really, why is this guy shirtless?
Right, yeah. And it's, I mean, it works in that context. But they kill the joke in the sequel. But having said that, I do like Robbie Amell's psycho killer energy. So having him back was not all bad. But then the Rinema rule of like bringing all of them back and then having and just for them to like be killed over again is just it just struck me as weak. And then we get into the ending where the time, effort, and energy to kill all the hench people seems to be wasted because they can just keep coming back again and again like Super Mario characters. It really doesn't do much for the stakes of the movie. And I feel bad for, well, a little bad, but they introduce like this new crew of high school characters who are friends with Cole and his friend Melanie, and we kind of don't really get anything with them, and you know, because they're kind of robbed of their impetus when the other characters from the original showed up too, and it just becomes a big. I don't know. It becomes a bit messy, and also because like the setting is a bit bigger. I'm not sure exactly where they shot it. It looked like Lake Powell, but you know, when because of the hugeness of the setting and because it's so hemmed so closely to the original, which was had the virtue of being tight in this one setting, it was too much. Let me put it that way. It was too much.
Yeah, I also wonder how you feel about the parent characters. So in the first film, the parents are in it pretty heavily for probably about the first act, and you know they're quirky and kind of hilarious. They're obviously the sort of overprotective parents of a slightly sensitive, anxiety-ridden boy, and it's funny. And then you know, we see them later on in the film for what I assume is supposed to be a funny sight gag. And I was just, that to me was like my least favorite part of the first film. I was like, yeah, no, like we could have just had the parents the way they were. We didn't need this scene. So when they came back for this film, I was a little concerned. I do love Ken Marino, and if I could see him in everything, it would be great. So, you know, I do really like him. But yeah, I'm interested in how you felt that was in this film, the bringing back of parents.
I don't know what the exact word is for it, but it was too much. Again, it was too much. And yeah, the I laughed at the sight gag in the first one, admittedly.
I'm sure most people did.
It was a nice kind of Family Guy style cutaway, and it suited the scene, it suited the film, because I mean, you know, you do want to have like explain at some point like where the parents are in the midst of, you know, this massacre that is happening in their home. But having said that, I like Camerino, of course. I like Leslie Bibb too. I think they make a good couple in this. But the whole thing with the dads getting high together, and then like the Chris Wilde, who plays Melanie's dad, who's totally obsessed with his car. Not so much obsessed with his daughter.
Well, I think it's stepdad, isn't it?
I thought he was his dad, her dad, but. I mean, regardless, he's the parental figure in her life, and he does more parenting to the car he lovingly painted flames on. It was a lot. It was I don't know who looked at the first movie and said, you know what this thing really needs is more scenes with the parents, or you know, we need a really good, you know, getting high gag in the year, you know, 2020, when, you know, marijuana is practically legalized everywhere now. It's a problem with, I think, because the original screenwriter didn't come back for this one. Actually, it's a similar problem to Happy Death Day, because the original screenwriter didn't come back for Happy Death Day Part 2. But because the original screenwriter didn't come back, you had four people essentially trying to replicate that tone. And when you're And we've talked about this before with horror comedies. It is such a tightrope. You have to know when to deke into comedy, when to deke into horror, and where the line is at all times. And because you don't have the guy who originated this idea and these characters involved in any way, you are assuming... you're making certain assumptions about... where that line is, and it doesn't always work. And the parents is just an example of that doesn't work. And by the way, they totally get rid of Leslie Bibb. I don't mean they kill the character, but they just kind of like tuck her away somewhere at some point, and it becomes the Ken Marino show, which again is fine because Ken Marino's a great actor and a very, very funny actor at that. But they just kind of like, okay, moms don't get high. Moms aren't interested in getting high or hanging out or doing stuff other than being moms. And yeah, that's
God
kind
knows
of a...
she's not going to be, you know, worried about her son. She's just at home waiting for the phone call from someone to say that her son is fine.
Right. And just like for all those reasons, it would have been fine if they had just said, you know what, they had just cut it off at the scene. Yes, the scene where Melanie's dad says that she's DTF, and that means ditching Thursday and Friday, which was a funny line, and I laughed out loud at that line, and they could have just left it there and just done what they did in the original, where mom and dad come in the end to after all the bloodletting is over, and that would have been fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a lot of... I mean, there are a lot of things in this that I did like, but then there are a lot of things, like, Cole is wearing a corduroy suit in all this.
Yeah, I was definitely going to mention that, and, you know, maybe I will give them props a little bit for bringing it up within the context, but yeah, of course, he goes to school in this three-piece corduroy suit, and he's getting bullied, and my first thought, of course, was, well, like, you know, why wear the suit? Which the character of Phoebe does ask him a little bit later. So I don't know. I don't know if that they get points then for that or if it doesn't take away from it. But I will say, just to bring everybody down, one of the kind of saddest and most truthful things I have heard, I have a friend who has a son who's a little awkward and has struggled fitting in and you know, been made fun of by classmates. And when my friend took them shopping to get some new clothes, you know, chose clothes that is more comfortable and that they want to wear, but is certainly not hip. And so my friend said to their son, "Are you sure that that's what you want? Because, you know, that's not really the kind of thing that other kids your age are wearing. They tend to wear these things." And the son said back, "Dad, they're going to make fun of me either way." And it was just like, oh, God. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of depressing that he's that sort of aware that it's like,
yeah,
you know what? I could try to do things to fit in, but it's probably not going to work. So I might as well just wear what I am going to feel comfortable in and deal with consequences. I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, that's heavy to hear that.
Yeah. I won't tell you the age of this kid when he said that either, because it's
good.
Younger than you'd like to hear.
Okay, good. Don't tell me. I get that. I've read in a couple of places, though, including on the IMDb Tribune, that it's an homage to Wes Anderson because Max Fisher wears a similar suit in Rushmore. And that makes sense for that character because he kind of wears his quirkiness on his sleeve. The character of Cole, though, I mean, first of all, corduroy is not comfortable. So it's not a matter of comfort. Three-piece suits, speaking from experience, are not comfortable. So when you combine the two, you're getting double the discomfort. But yeah, the whole idea of like sticking out like a sore thumb like that, you know, being basically the only kid in school in a three-piece suit, even putting aside the corduroy, I think that, you know, it's one of these things, and another Anderson does this a lot, Paul W.S. Anderson, where he like throws in details because he thinks it makes him look quirky and makes him look, you know, zeitgeisty. You know, I got my finger on the pulse, so I'm throwing in this Easter egg reference to the X-Files and Alien vs. Predator. See how hip I am. And I feel like that's something that was going on in this movie, is with the corduroy suit, because I think if for the homage to work, what they should have done with Cole is, instead of being like the introvert he was in the first movie, he's become like the Max Fisher type. In order to get over the whole thing where he was almost sacrificed, he's become so extroverted, where he's in all the school activities and, you know, maybe chronicling his trauma with a school play about a babysitter trying to sacrifice him to Satan. I don't know. But it just seems like somebody had the idea, hey, wouldn't it be funny if he was wearing that corduroy suit from Rushmore? Let's do it. And it's one of these things that directors like McGee, and I'm only going to say McGee once, because the rest of the time, if he comes up again, I'm going to use his full real name, which is Joseph McGinty Nickel, because I looked it up. He's 52 years old, and he should not be going by McGee anymore. He is not Madonna. He has not earned what she has. But the whole thing of it is, too, that, and this goes into another thing I had an issue with, there's a fight scene between two of the female characters, and for some reason, it becomes like a Street Fighter, like, homage, where there's, like, video game effects and status bars, and I'm like, oh, McGinty, did you, like, watch Scott Pilgrim versus the World last night? Is that what's going on here? And it just, again, it's because the original screenwriter isn't there. He isn't there to set the barometer, to set the meter, so that everyone knows where the levels are. And so you have McGinty, not McGee, I'm going to say McGinty, just throwing stuff at the wall to see what works, because this is what he thinks is hip and cool and now, or whatever is going on in his head. And it just, all it does is throw off the temperament of the movie, and you're sitting there wondering, why are we doing this, instead of just sort of enjoying the scene.
Yeah. I definitely hear you on that, and I think there was And to be fair, this was sort of the case with the first movie too. We don't actually know what time frame these films are set in, but you know, certainly in, there are sort of music cues that make you think that maybe it could be sort of set in the 90s, but who really knows? But I definitely, you know, without any way of us actually knowing, I just sort of watch it thinking there's nothing really to tell me what time it is, so I'm going to assume that it's now. And so these two, what, 15, 16? He said he's a junior, right? So 16-year-old mm-hmm. kids are trying to find the... what's the word I'm looking for? The code for the safe. Mm-hmm. And somehow remember Tommy Two Tones.
Right.
And the lyrics to Jenny and the you know, of course, the phone number, 867-5309. And I'm just like, I don't, like, let's break this down a little bit. So you're 16. Your parents, probably the same age as you and I, maybe a little bit younger. Yeah. Maybe a little bit older. It's hard to say because I'd say our generation had sort of a 20-year span of deciding when to have kids. So let's say their parents are maybe in their late 30s or early 40s, which means they were probably not even alive when the song came out. And sure, like, I know the song, but it's not like it's one that is so popular that if I had kids, I would be like, kids, you definitely have to listen to this one-hit wonder that was so popular to my parents when I was only two. It just, I don't know. It's a little weird. And, I mean, that's not the only, like I say, music cue that's I don't understand. And I think that similar to the switching to the Street Fighter-esque sort of thing, it's just really leaning on nostalgia.
Yeah.
And even though it's teens, obviously, I think it's they're basically trying to market it to us, to people in our age category. And maybe that's why they keep going back to the parents so much too. It's like the, you know.
Mm-hmm. There are multiple things wrong with the Jenny thing. And one of them is as you said, like, there's no frame of reference, because I don't think Justin Bieber or Selena Gomez or anyone who a teenager would listen to has covered that song, and why would they? But there's a scene where they get into the boat, and it says Jenny on the boat, and the camera lingers there for a minute, and it's like, remember this reference. It is going to come in very important later. And I'm like, okay. So I see that the boat is Jenny. I'm supposed to pick up on that. What does this mean? Have I forgotten about a character in the first one named Jenny? Is this a reference to Forrest Gump? And one of the characters makes that connection, as I did, that the shrimping boat that Forrest buys after he comes back from Nam, he names it the Jenny in honor of his friend. And, you know, that's also kind of like an outdated reference, I would feel, for most kids. I don't think a lot of kids are sitting down to watch Forrest Gump these days. So, you know, what is this for? And then we get into the thing, it's like, oh, it's a reference. And somebody says something about the song Jenny, about Tommy Two Tone. And I was like, Tommy Two Tone? Is that the reference? And it was the reference. That's the combination of the boat. Yeah. It turns out 867-5309. And I'm just like, yeah, you know, I never would have put two and two together. And this is kind of, quote-unquote, my era. And it just, yeah, somebody was really massaging that. I mean, that seems like straight up, like, out of, like, a comedy writer's, like, room, like some sort of focus group. It's like, we need a good combination joke. And it just seemed like it was workshopped to death to bend this and mold it and stick it in.
I don't think anyone's going to be upset if they take the time to watch it.
No.
And no, if you really, really enjoyed the first one, then watch this one, and there's some fun in it and some good stuff. But, you know, you could also just watch the first one and keep that one.
Absolutely. And I would concur with all that and not add anything because we're out of time. So, Candace, how can people find you on the internet?
I can be found on the internet on literally every social network ever at CINN48, that's CINN48. About once a month or so on the Bookshelf podcast, The Village by the Bookshelf.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And while you are on Spotify, search for End Credits on CFRU, and you can get the playlist of all the music you hear here on End Credits on your Spotify app. Again, just look for End Credits on CFRU. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. You can find me tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out GuelphPolitico.ca. And you can also read about my writings on horror movies, which you can find at Nightmare on Film Street, which is at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we'll see you then.